Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and it's that time of the week again when we visit with Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mutin, who is going to help me field your questions. Welcome once again, Layla.
Hi, Dr. Hoffman. Thank you.
And we'll mention again to our podcast listeners that the way to get questions routed to us is send them to radioprogram@AOL.com. Radioprogram@AOL.com gets you into the doctor's and the nutritionist's office for a dual consultation on your particular health concern. If it's an issue, should pregnant women take selenium, for example, we'll answer that. Or if you have a particular health predicament, we will endeavor to provide you with a intelligent medicine perspective. And we're going to do it in a tag team fashion as usual. So starting with you, Layla, what do you got?
Oh, let's see. This is from Clay. He emails us, "Hello, Dr. Hoffman. About a year ago, I spoke to you regarding my problem." His problem is aortic stenosis. He probably talked to you on the radio.
He must be on the radio, yeah. Because he's not a patient. I don't recall him as a patient.
Yeah. "On February 3rd, I'm getting the valve replaced. I'd appreciate any suggestions regarding pre- and post-op, for example, stopping any supplements, taking any additional supplements, also any safeguards to prevent infection. Thank you."
Okay. So this brings up a question in general about supplements for surgery, and we actually have a pretty nice section at drhoffman.com on that very question. It's actually one of our more popular articles where we talk about the supplements to take and the supplements not to take. And as you know, Layla, all too often conventional doctors tell patients, well, you know, we don't know how these things are going to interact with surgery. They're unfamiliar with supplements. So they say, look, I don't know what the heck you're taking. I mean, some of these things I don't even recognize. So you're better off just not taking any of your supplements a few days before surgery and a few days afterwards. That's what the general advice is. And that advice, unfortunately, I mean, it's partially right, but it's also dead wrong because supplements help people recover better from surgery.
Absolutely.
So why don't we tackle first, I'll talk in particular about aortic stenosis, but let's talk about surgery in general. What are some of the supplements that really probably you should stop when you're undergoing surgery?
The supplements to stop a week or maybe even 2 weeks before surgery are the blood thinning supplements. If you're taking fish oil or any other type of oil, a higher amount of vitamin E, possibly a lower amount may be okay. Other blood thinners like ginkgo biloba, a flax oil, things of that nature.
Ginger is sometimes cited.
Mm-hmm. A little too much vitamin C can have a blood thinning effect. If you're taking a daily aspirin, certainly your doctor would have you stop that as well, or at least they should. These are the ones to stop, I would say, a week to 2 weeks before.
And I have to say, though, I'm a little bit perplexed by data that suggests that people who are taking fish oil do better with at least one type of surgery, which is heart surgery. And, you know, it's a little hard to piece together the data. I think that generally it's a good idea. You know, if you are going to take something which might increase your bleeding time, surgeons just hate when they nick an artery and it just bleeds and bleeds and bleeds and they can't achieve what's called hemostasis, which is stopping the blood flow. And I must admit that, you know, the one time that I've had surgery is when I broke my hip and I lost a lot of blood. And maybe that just was, you know, the result of the accident. But I suspect it's because I had taken a lot of fish oil right up and, you know, to that point. And so, you know, I was a candidate for a high level of blood loss. So I think it is advisable in general to not take fish oil right before surgery, maybe, you know, a couple of weeks before, because it takes a while to get out of your system. That being said, there are some nutrients that we really want people to take because, and, you know, what's interesting is when I was in my medical training, I was always interested in nutrition, but comes a point in a young medical student's medical training when they have to decide what branch of medicine do they want to get into. And the first basic fork in the road is, do you want to go into internal medicine, Or do you want to go into surgery? And there are many surgical fields, you know, it's like general surgery and there's urology and there's plastic surgery. And that's a whole, you know, all the different subspecialties of surgery. And then there's internal medicine, which all, with all its subspecialties like cardiology and endocrinology and, you know, you name it. OBGYN is sort of a surgical field to some extent. So I had to make that decision, and I had to say, I noticed that the surgeons were more concerned with nutrition than the internal medicine doctors that I saw.
Why is that? Because of bleeding.
Well, not so much because of bleeding. Uh-huh. It was more that, you know, when a patient undergoes surgery, it's a very vulnerable time. And you want to do everything you can to make the patient survive the surgery and have a better outcome. So what they would do is, often patients who are sick, they have terrible nutrition. They've been sick. They might have, you know, severe gastrointestinal problems, colitis, cancer, something that impairs the nutrition. So what surgeons do frequently is they try to augment a patient's nutrition, even using intravenous nutrition or total parenteral nutrition. They've done a lot of research on how to get a patient in better shape so that they can survive the surgery and heal faster. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, the old expression, you know, the operation was a success, but the patient died. That so often happens in surgery because the patient is in poor shape and doesn't withstand even an excellent, correct surgery. They don't, their wound healing is poor. They get all kinds of complications, infections. They languish in the surgical ICU and then they die.
Yeah.
So the surgeons are big into nutrition. But that being said, unfortunately, there is less of an emphasis on, you know, simply the oral vitamins that will help you do better. So what are some of those that help with wound healing and immunity and recovery?
Wound healing, immunity, one of the things that's, I think, severely depleted is magnesium, for one thing, after surgery. Certainly all of our other nutrients, because we've been NPO now for at least a good 24 hours, meaning no food by mouth, no intake at all.
I'll mention, you know, again, an anecdote from, you know, you learn a lot when you have an injury. It's terrible having an injury, but I learned a lot from my experience. When I went in with my broken hip 6 years ago, some of you, you know, follow that episode because I talked about it on the radio. The first thing that I told the doctors, you know, after they told me I had a broken hip, is I said, could you please give me some intravenous nutrition and make sure there's some magnesium in it? And they said, yeah. And they kind of yesed me, but they didn't give me anything. And a few days later, you know, I kept waiting for them to give me the magnesium. Every time they hung a bottle over my bed, you know, I said, is that the magnesium? They said, no, that's not magnesium. That's a blood thinner. That's an antibiotic, whatever. Mm-hmm. It took 3 days until they finally gave me some magnesium. And the doctor came by and he said, you know, you were right. You were low in magnesium. I said, well, why didn't you give me the magnesium ahead of time before I became depleted? I had an accident. I was in shock. I mean, sure. I was in a minor form of shock. Trauma causes shock. Surgery puts you sometimes in a shocky state. That really depletes your magnesium.
Yeah.
So what could that do? It could make you more prone to cardiac arrhythmias. It could make you very tired. It could put you into terrible muscle spasm, which isn't great when you have a broken hip. So, yes, magnesium is really essential. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sometimes they pay attention to it in hospitals, but all too often they don't. So, yeah, you want to make sure you have adequate magnesium.
Yeah. So, magnesium for wound healing, I would say immediately. Vitamin C for, you know, production of collagen, zinc. Often we get infection in hospital. It's also to prevent infection. Other things to promote keep scar tissue from occurring. Bromelain.
Right.
Or other enzymes, systemic enzymes, are very helpful.
Plastic surgeons recommend that now, as they tell patients to take bromelain. And we sometimes amp it up a little bit. We give patients systemic enzymes like Wob enzyme, which contains proteolytic enzymes plus bromelain and some other ingredients to reduce swelling, you know, because you have swelling and inflammation after surgery, and that's something that keeps that down and helps to promote healing. So those
other things for energy, especially metabolism, carnitine is also helpful, selenium for the immune system. But, you know, then we have to decide when we're able to get back on those blood thinning medications. I think when the patient is free and clear, when they've had a post-op visit with the surgeon, everything is healing nicely, I think it's safe then to start your fish oil, your ginkgo, your higher dose vitamin E. all of that.
We even give patients what is termed a pre-op IV. And we've actually had some patients that I've been a little concerned about. They're older, they're a little debilitated, and they're going for a joint replacement surgery. They come in and they get a couple of intravenous treatments, and many of them have breezed through surgery. They've done exceptionally well when we weren't so sure they were going to do okay. So that really boosts up your levels of vitamin C and other critical nutrients. It's sort of a cocktail of nutrients that you get via an IV bag.
Your nutrition status is critically important before a surgery, because afterwards, one of the things that goes up is our protein requirements are highest after a trauma,
yes,
such as surgery.
You get very catabolic. You become,
yes,
catabolic. You lose muscle mass. Yes.
Mm-hmm. So that's critically important to replace all of that. Maybe that's why the surgeons are so into nutrition.
Yeah, no, but they actually give it
much higher.
They give it parenterally through an IV. You know, it's the TPN is a big surgical subspecialty. It's a big deal. Also, it's, you know, it's a make sure you have adequate vitamin D status. That's especially helpful, you know, if you've got a fracture, you know, bone surgery, any kind of bone surgery, but overall immunity too.
Mm-hmm.
One other nutrient that is intriguing for surgery, and it's actually something that was studied while I was a medical student way back when. This must have been 30 years ago. There was a brilliant scientist at my medical school named Dr. Sam Seifter, and he was very much beloved by the students because he gave great lectures. And his thing was arginine. And he was really big on arginine for promotion of immunity and recovery. It seems to boost levels of nitric oxide, which may help circulation. It may have an immune-enhancing effect. And he did a lot of research on arginine as a pre-op or post-op treatment for surgical patients. In fact, there is a surgical preparation, and the ingredients are, it's got some vitamins, it's got arginine, it's got RNA, RNA, which is a genetic material, and it has some fish oil in it.
Wow.
And it is used as a, I think it's called IMPACT, I-M-P-A-C-A-T. I'm not sure if it's still being used, but the idea was to boost patients' immunity prior to surgery to get them ready for surgery. And, you know, unfortunately, these days, and I remember very well in the hospital, what they did is they brought me a lot of Ensure.
Oh.
That was their answer to building me up around the time of surgery.
Oh, gosh.
Which I rejected, but the only problem was that I couldn't get him to take it away, so it just kept piling up to the point
where... Did you build a nice little pyramid?
It was
for
a pyramid.
And
I couldn't see the TV after a while. It was the only thing that was distracting me from my misery as I was lying on my back. And I finally said, you know, they said, would you like to see the nutritionist? I said, yes, please bring the nutritionist. I want to see the nutritionist now. They said, good, because I hadn't asked for the nutritionist. And I said, there's one thing you can do for me. I said, could you please get all these blankety-blank cans of Ensure off my table? That's all I need from you, because I am a professional medical nutritionist. I really don't need to hear what your hospital nutrition has to offer me, because I have some ideas of my own, and I'm taking my own vitamins.
I'll tell you that...
I had to smuggle vitamins in.
Sure. I remember one of the most ungratifying things about being a hospital dietitian when I was all that Ensure, and the lack of really... being able to affect that patient outcome, unless it's something like TPN, total parenteral, which is very exciting and fun, but many of those patients can die and so forth. But that was one of the drawbacks of hospital dietetics and nutrition. Hopefully that will change over time.
Yeah, hopefully there will be more than just Jell-O on hospital patients' plates. Okay, so let's talk about the guy's aortic stenosis. So aortic stenosis is actually a pretty common condition that a lot of people get, because what happens is the valves of the aorta get calcified with age, sort of like barnacles on a ship's hull. And it is accelerated if you have bad cholesterol, if you have diabetes, but it also, there's a little bit of an inevitability to it as you age. Virtually no one dies at the ripe old age of 90 or 100 without some aortic calcification. So it's a question of whether the aortic calcification is bad enough to make the valve so stiff that it doesn't permit blood to flow through, or that it allows blood to leak back. And then you have to get the valve fixed. You can get it replaced. You can get it simply opened up. It sounds like a huge surgery, but it actually is fairly routine and successful in very old individuals, and it's something that really extends people's lives. They are now contemplating ways of doing it without cracking the chest.
You know, laparoscopically?
Even beyond laparoscopically, they may be able to do it via an artery in the leg. You know, like angioplasty.
Yeah.
You know, and just open up some kind of cutting tool or replacement tool, or open up the replacement valve like an umbrella inserted via the catheter. I mean, they're doing all kinds of amazing things. I don't know if it's ready for prime time yet. Some of it's being done in Europe, and some of this is being imported to the United States gradually because the FDA is conservative. It can be life-saving. One thing, if that's the type of surgery that's contemplated, I really recommend coenzyme Q10 because it will actually help restore the pumping action of the heart. The heart goes through a little bit of a change when it's been working hard against a bad valve. And when you put in a new valve that functions well, it actually takes a little time for the heart muscle to get used to the new valve. And trouble can ensue in the first few weeks. Mm-hmm. It's this process called remodeling. The heart remodels to adapt to a properly functioning valve. And when you put a properly functioning valve in there, there can be problems. So I would recommend, obviously, magnesium, taurine, coenzyme Q10.
Maybe D-ribose.
D-ribose, which is something that can also enhance the pumping action of the heart, according to Dr. Steven Sinatra. He's got, you know, those carnitine. These are the nutrients that seem to help support heart function. So there we have. That's a pretty good consult for our friend there who just called on the radio.
Yeah.
All right. What's next?
Let's see here. This is from a woman who emails in, Dear Dr. Hoffman, she has lichen planopilaris of the scalp.
Mm-hmm.
She says,
otherwise known in veterinary medicine as the mange.
Oh.
No, I'm just being facetious, but I guess it in some ways resembles the animal mange.
Hmm.
You know, like the mangy dog phenomenon where, you know, the dog has like, you know, cruddy, scabby skin and dandruff. I mean, a dermatologist might scoff at that analogy because it's a precise subtype of dermatological condition.
Mm-hmm.
But for all the world, it resembles mangy dog skin condition.
Okay. She says, I'm already on low-dose naltrexone. She has an indolent form of Sjogren's and Raynaud's. So she has autoimmune.
She has autoimmune stuff going on.
Time too.
Yeah.
She follows a gluten and dairy-free diet. She takes Dr. O'Hara's probiotic and many supplements that are anti-inflammatory and immune-boosting. It's hard to find information on it, though I've been searching for years. Heartfelt thanks from a loyal fan and former patient now living in the South. Bless you for everything you do and have shared through the years and continue to. You are a gift to our health and spirit that keeps on giving.
Well, that's very kind.
That's very nice.
That's very nice to hear. So, you know, this, obviously there's an autoimmune character to this. And the low-dose naltrexone is interesting in that respect because we know that it helps many autoimmune conditions. So I'm all for low-dose naltrexone. It's something that has to be prescribed by a doctor. Studies have been done with it in Crohn's disease, and I think they're beginning to look at it in multiple sclerosis. And I've seen it help some patients with very hard-to-treat skin conditions. I'm not sure it's going to work here. Obviously, it's not done the full job.
Yeah. I would make sure that she's absolutely strict with her gluten-free, dairy-free regimen. First of all, I think another helpful thing to do is maybe the avoidance of nightshades. But I think a paleo diet, going all the way to paleo, may really be it. That's really the bottom line,
okay.
I think, for anybody with autoimmunity.
For our listening audience, explain what that might entail.
Paleo diet, it goes beyond gluten and dairy-free. It's absolutely grain-free. There is no grain food group at all. It's basically what our Paleolithic ancestors ate, the animals they killed, the fish they caught, the roots and shoots that they gathered and harvested, the berries and the nuts and the seeds. That's essentially it.
Right.
No processed food anything.
It's very restricted, but it leaves a fair amount of food choices. You just have to be careful. Nobody is starved on that program. And it sounds a little draconian, but, you know, you have a very bothersome condition like this. It might be worth a try for 60 days or 90 days to see if it responds. I agree. I would want to make sure, I mean, this sounds like an astute listener, and she's been a patient here, so she knows. Take a lot of essential fatty acids. Make sure you take really high doses, 6 or 8 capsules of fish oil daily, and some borage oil, which also mm-hmm. has a hydrating effect on the skin. Very helpful in many skin conditions.
Curcumin, boswellia.
Curcumin internally, but you know, I learned of something mm-hmm. New recently, which is curcumin topical. Mm-hmm. There are topical curcumin preparations. One is something like Soraya Cure, with a C-U-R for like the cure. Mm-hmm. I think that's one proprietary product, but there are many brands of topical curcumin now. Curamin is another brand, I think, of topical curcumin. And, you know, you can troll around the internet, or you can ask in a health food store if that's something that is available. You might try applying that to the scalp. I mean, I would probably pick one area, one small discrete area, to see if the skin is not hypersensitive to it. It mm-hmm. could have a, you know, it could have an irritating effect. But it's an anti-inflammatory. It's a very potent anti-inflammatory, and you might want to put it right on the scalp where, you know, where the
tissue
is affected.
Is this something where light therapy might help or anything like that?
Well, you know, certain conditions like psoriasis respond to ultraviolet, and certain don't. And I think that mm-hmm. that's for the dermatologist to determine, because that's one of their modalities. I think they're pretty attuned to that. Another thing that might be helpful, I think that this Manuka cream that we're now using for skin conditions is remarkable. I've had scrapes and skin irritations and even, you know, superficial acne respond remarkably quickly to that, because it's honey. Mm-hmm. And honey is
antimicrobial.
It's antimicrobial.
Yeah.
But, and I'm not saying this is just an infection, but it may be super infected with bacteria or fungus. And that the natural compounds from Manuka cream are from the plant that the bee goes to. And you get a little bit of that natural compound when the bee makes honey from that plant. It's really a nice anti-inflammatory. I find it very helpful. It's worth a try in many skin conditions.
There is one thing I forgot to say, and it's great to be gluten-free, dairy-free, but you also must be sugar-free.
Mm-hmm.
Sugar is going to feed any bad bacteria,
okay,
including lichen planopilaris, pilaris, or I've seen very good result being gluten-free, sugar-free, dairy-free with lichen planus. We have a couple of patients who've done very well. They were able to clear that.
Yeah, this may be a variant of that. Yeah, mm-hmm. lichen planus is a much more common condition, very, mm-hmm. you know, scaly skin condition. The other thing, you know, you might try ModuCare, which is generally helpful for autoimmunity. We mm-hmm. use it in many autoimmune conditions, like we could use it in scleroderma, rheumatoid arthritis. It's mm-hmm. a product made by the same Wakanaga, the company that makes Kyolic, makes ModuCare. And the other thing to investigate is the yeast connection. And I'm not saying that this is just simply a fungal infection in your scalp. That would be oversimplifying, because a dermatologist would recognize that. But sometimes people, in spite of good diets, still carry yeast. And a trial of antifungal medication sometimes, or natural herbs, can sometimes help these problems. So, you know, those are some of the things that we have available to us in our natural dermatology arsenal. And, you know, those might be worth exploring. But I ask one favor from this listener. Yeah, mm-hmm. olive leaf, too, because it's a good natural antifungal. I ask one thing from this listener, which is, if any of this works, please let us know, because we'd like to get some feedback, because then we can pass it along to the rest of our listeners. Yes, olive leaf. Tell us about olive leaf.
Olive leaf is a potent antimicrobial, antifungal, best taken internally, but also olive leaf soap.
Yep.
That might be helpful
yep.
in this case. Again, check with your dermatologist
for
the expertise on
that. I'm going to throw out one more, and this is extra virgin coconut oil.
Oh, yeah.
Or EVCO. EVCO. It turns out it has to be extra virgin, you know, just like extra virgin olive oil, because processed coconut oil does not contain the lauric acid and other helpful antimicrobial compounds.
It should be unrefined.
Unrefined, yeah. Yes. And it basically looks like old-fashioned Brill Cream hair pomade or
it looks like a
Crisco,
glacier.
Or Crisco.
Or Crisco.
Right. Yeah, right. But it's you apply it to the skin, and it. I'm not saying it's a panacea for every skin condition, but a lot of studies have been done in allergic dermatitis, mm-hmm. which is a broad category of skin conditions, sometimes comprises eczema. And it is very helpful because it's lubricating, which is good for dry skin conditions, but also it may have anti-infective properties with the lauric acid. It seems to kill superficial bacteria and fungus pretty mm-hmm. well. And there's some other natural compounds in there that appear to be effective. They've done actual
Capric
research.
Acid, caprylic acid.
Caprylic acid, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All of that.
So there, I mean, what we've given you know, for our listeners is not necessarily a specific treatment for this rather niched, unusual skin condition, but a series of possibilities that can yield good results with hard-to-treat skin problems. I mean, that's the basic tutorial on that. Okay. What else we got?
Let's see here. Oh. This is from Michael. He emails us, "Dear Dr. Hoffman, would you please discuss non-allergic rhinitis? I always thought that the runny nose and sneezing symptoms that I experienced during fall and spring were due to an allergic reaction to ragweed pollens, etc. However, I get bouts of the same symptoms during the winter as well. My research indicates that it may be due to non-allergic rhinitis. Your podcasts are the best thing that happened since the discovery of vitamins. Warm wishes for a happy and healthy holiday season and New Year."
Well, yeah. I think Linus Pauling might take offense at that, but that's very kind anyway. All right, so I think that the term non-allergic rhinitis is kind of a cop-out myself. It's a little bit like irritable bowel syndrome, yeah. You know, where if they can't find what's causing your GI symptoms, they say, well, you just have IBS. And
diagnosis of exclusion.
Right. It's a wastebasket diagnosis. They can't find what's causing it, so they just say, you know, that's it. Often learn to live with it. They tell you sometimes to, mm-hmm. you know, take some fiber, Metamucil, whatever. So with non-allergic rhinitis, it's a little bit the same. You get you may be missing a true allergic cause. So, for example, a conventional allergist might do skin testing or even blood testing for dust, mold, pollen, and all that stuff. And everything comes up negative, but you're saying that's crazy because my nose is running all the time. I'm sneezing. What could it possibly be? Well, it could be that you have a hidden gluten intolerance, which could be diagnosed with a blood test or with a simple trial of elimination of gluten. It could be a dairy intolerance.
I mean, dairy is a big mucus maker. Can
yes.
we just say that?
Yeah.
It makes mucus and phlegm, and giving it up, it's amazing. We see people get rid of their rhinitis. They get rid of their postnasal drip. They get rid of headaches. They get rid of congestion. It's amazing. So these are things to try. Even if you're not getting tested for these, do a trial elimination at home. There's no reason you can't give up dairy. Dairy is anything made from an animal's milk. That's milk, yogurt, cheese, ice cream. People mistakenly think eggs are dairy, but I think that was from the days of the milkman, number one. And number two, it's in the grocery, it's in the dairy aisle, the
right.
eggs are. So giving up milk products can be very, very helpful. You may notice a difference in as little as 2 weeks.
Yeah, I mean,
so dairy and gluten, or those would be the first
the main culprits.
Yeah.
The other thing that can happen, I mean, it could be other foods, and we test for a variety of foods using an IgG RAST test that is often helpful at giving us information.
What about all that trapped bacteria and the
yes,
biofilms
yeah.
and the thing that something like clear
okay.
nasal spray is great for?
This is the new thing, and I've just I'm always fascinated by scientific articles that kind of go beyond current medical practice, because medical practice is limited, sort of like, here's the drill, you know, test for allergies, give allergy shots, here's some sprays. That's in the doctor's repertoire. But I always like when researchers go beyond that and say, you know, what's really causing a certain disease? And what they've come to the conclusion of is that with many patients who have sinusitis or even just chronic nasal congestion without active bacterial infection, they are allergic to their own bacteria. Bacteria which actually may not cause a problem in other people. Now, I'm sure you'll agree that if I'm sitting across from you having a conversation and I pick my nose, and then at the end of the conversation I offer to shake your hand, you're going to think twice about shaking my hand, right?
Yes.
Even though I don't have a sinus infection, but noses are dirty places. They have bacteria. This is like natural. In fact, there's natural flora present in the nose, just as there is in the mouth, in the genital areas, you know, in your gastrointestinal tract. That's natural. But it seems that through some sort of immunological mistake, patients who have chronic nasal congestion become sensitized to their own bacteria. So you can give them antibiotics till kingdom come. After a while, the bacteria will become resistant, and then they won't do any good when you need them. So what we like to do is we like to clear it out with a product called Clear. You tell us a little bit about Clear because you're very familiar with it.
Clear nasal spray is actually xylitol. The wonderful thing is this is not medication. It's not a steroid. It's not something that once you stop using it that you'll get a rebound congestion or infection from or anything like that. It's about keeping your nose clean.
Yep.
I forget the author, the doctor who wrote that book about xylitol and the importance of keeping your nose clean. And you use this spray up to 4 to even 6 times a day, but you want to use it consistently. And it can help rid you of the bacteria, and it's completely, completely safe. It's xylitol.
Right. And the bacteria seem to hide in what are called biofilms, which makes it difficult to eradicate. The biofilm, if you think about it, look under a microscope, it looks like a giant metropolis with apartment houses for the bacteria. It's multi-layers, it's very complex, and the bacteria like to hang out there, and the xylitol, in effect, breaks that up so that the bacteria have no place to run, no place to hide, and your own immune system can dispose of them, or, you know, your mucus layer will just float out as you blow your nose and the bacteria will be disposed of.
That you're taking care of the cause and not the symptom. A regular decongestant nasal spray is only going to take care of the symptom.
Right.
The congestion. So this is actually taking care of the problem, which is exactly what you want.
Right. Okay, so in terms of things that are natural antihistamines, there are some, and among them are quercetin, and we actually have a nice product.
Dehist,
and it has bromelain, quercetin.
Sinitrol. We have Sinitrol.
Sinitrol, which also is a little more for if you have an infection or really seriously mm-hmm. inflamed sinuses. By the way, drhoffman.com is the place to go to get information about the supplements we talk about here.
Taking higher doses of vitamin C has a nice antihistamine effect. If it's allergy-related, that's also very, very helpful. But really, the avoidance of gluten, dairy, or at least a trial avoidance of both would be very, very helpful.
So I just want to make a different comment here, is that one of the reasons that I really enjoy a teamwork approach with you, Layla, is because without a nutritionist in a medical nutrition practice, it just doesn't make sense, because I can tell a patient a bunch of stuff like, don't eat this, don't eat that, or I can say, here, take these vitamins, or I can even put them on medication. But without a sit-down, a prolonged, usually a 30, 40-minute session or longer with you to say, well, what's left to eat? How can I plan my diet? What do I have for breakfast, lunch, and dinner? What do I eat when I go on the road? If I'm busy at the office, what can I eat? It's very hard to implement that. And also there's a certain amount of, when you see a professional nutritionist with a meal plan and you keep a diet log, you have a certain accountability. I think that's really about 60% of how we get patients better here at the Hoffman
yeah.
Center is
yeah.
through a diet change. And unfortunately, I have to say that some practices where they do medical nutrition, they more pay lip service to us. They say, well, here's your diet, or they'll hand you a sheet or something. But that's not enough, because it really requires a profound change in the way you eat to get well with many conditions, most conditions. And if you're not ready to make that change, actually, we discourage people from coming to see us. We vet people pretty carefully when they call on the phone, and we say, look, you know, if you know, are you ready? Is your child ready? Will they really make a commitment? And it requires actually a certain amount of determination and sometimes desperation on the part of patients to make that change. But I give them enormous credit that they're ready to make that commitment, because it's a lot easier to take a pill. Unfortunately, the pills don't deliver results, and they often have a lot of side effects.
They don't. They don't deliver the results. They're only taking care of the symptom and not the cause. And how far do we want to go with that? The other danger in just being handed a diet by your conventional doctor, who's not nutritionally trained like you are, is that they're oftentimes giving you the wrong diet. You know, here's this. Eat this way for diverticulosis or diverticulitis. They don't know about specific carbohydrate diet. They're simply telling you to eat fiber or don't eat fiber, or eat residue or don't have residue, but nobody's really putting it together for them.
Right. And so, another example is a gout diet that tells people to eliminate meat and purines, but doesn't tell people to eliminate excess juice and fruit and carbohydrates that drive uric acid up.
They completely miss the connection with insulin resistance and gout. So this is information that we have that's very important. The people who are willing to change their diets, like you say, they've suffered enough, but they also understand a fundamental truth in integrative medicine is that food is information. Food has the ability to turn genes on and certain genes off. Think about your car. Would you ever put anything other than gasoline in your car? Would you put apple juice in there? Would you put anything other than gasoline in your car?
Actually, I just saw a movie. It's about the old moonshine days in, I think it's done in West Virginia. And part of the plot line is the car runs out of gas, and these moonshiners with a shipment of moonshine are being chased, and the car, they have one of these old tin Lizzies, it's the Depression, and this car laden with moonshine whiskey runs out of gas. And they go, oh, darn. And then one of the guys says, hey, I got an idea. He goes to the back of the truck, he takes one of the jars of moonshine, puts it in the gas tank, and puts the pedal in the middle, and man, does that car go.
There you go, folks.
I'm not sure what condition the engine would be at the end of that. They don't show it, but maybe that's how people sometimes get through their day, with rocket fuel instead of proper food. So, you know, there are exceptions to what you put in your, you know, when you put the wrong thing in your gas tank, your car may seem to go.
But it's not
going to be good for the car.
Exactly.
So, all right. So what's on deck for, we've got, you know, this week we had a very, very exciting seminar on the subject of
menopause and andropause.
With a view towards debunking some of the negative propaganda about testosterone therapy for men. You know, even worse, this whole A-Rod thing has cast a pall on the use of natural testosterone, which, you know, he didn't really use. He used, you know, synthetic compounds, injections, and so on, which are not natural. But, you know, there is something to the performance-enhancing benefits of testosterone. It's just that, okay, you make a decision that you want to rule that out in professional sports, fine. That's a bad example to our kids, our young people. You want to keep the sport clean, fine, okay. But that we should not throw the baby out with the bathwater in terms of the potential benefits of these bioidentical hormones. So that was exciting this week. What's on tap? Because we're going to address something very important in February.
Yes, February 26th, we're going to address this war on natural medicine. That will be Wednesday, February 26th. Reservations are a must. You must call us to reserve your seat, 212-779-1744. That's the War on Natural Medicine, February 26th. You and I will be presenting.
And we're building that as an emergency summit.
Absolutely.
Because
it is an emergency. A headline every day, every other day. This is really unbelievable.
Well, I have to say that I've really been doing my homework on that subject. It was very frustrating to me that story broke during a hiatus in my radio show. During the month of December, my show wasn't airing, and I was just chomping at the bit.
They must have known. Dr. Hoffman's off the air. Now we could,
exactly.
Now we could hit him with some propaganda.
Let's release the paper simultaneous with his absence from the radio airways. We'll see if we can slip this one by. But we came back quickly with a lot of damage control. You can listen to some of the podcasts at drhoffman.com/podcasts. But for the general public, we're going to do it's going to be sort of like a tent revival meeting. I think a lot of people who are believe in supplements.
Hallelujah!
Hallelujah! And we're going to actually provide them with the facts that they need to counter the arguments of the naysayers. It may be the press, but it also may be well-meaning relative who is saying, "Oh, come on now, you've seen all the vitamin studies," or perhaps you'll go to the doctor's office, and the doctor's office, the doctor will say, "Well, you see these studies that all just came out, I've been telling you for so many years that the vitamins you take are worthless." Well, we're going to push back against that media propaganda and the flawed studies that were recently touted as case closed.
Mm-hmm.
No need to discuss vitamins anymore. It's over for vitamins and supplements. Certainly, that is so not the case. So I'm looking forward to that. That's on the 26th?
That's on the 26th of February, yes.
Okay, great. So that's all the time that we have for today's edition of the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and our guest, of course, Layla Mutin. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
You've just listened to a free podcast brought to you by yours truly and the Hoffman Center. F-R-E-E is my favorite four-letter word, but these podcasts do involve time and money to produce. And so in the spirit of defraying some of our very real production costs and to keep these podcasts flowing, I'd like to ask you to consider a couple of things. First, if you like what you're hearing, please share these podcasts with your friends and relatives. Our object is to continue the spectacular growth of the Intelligent Medicine Podcast with the goal of attaining 250,000 podcast downloads per month in 2014. I know that with the help of dedicated listeners like you, it'll happen. Second, go to drhoffman.com and click on the store and consider buying your supplements via our convenient internet portal, or call the Hoffman Center and talk to one of our friendly supplement advisors. We only stock the very highest quality supplements, some of which are very hard to find elsewhere, the very same supplements that I talk about here on Intelligent Medicine and that I prescribe to my patients at the Hoffman Center. And finally, consider becoming a patient at the Hoffman Center. I can personally perform an extensive workup on you, applying all the Intelligent Medicine principles that you hear about on these podcasts, or, alternatively, make an appointment with Layla Mutin, our Hoffman Center nutritionist. You already know her as a frequent contributor on Intelligent Medicine. And she'll provide you with expert advice on diet and supplements. Anyway, thanks for listening and continue enjoying our Intelligent Medicine podcasts.